The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, who should pay for the costs of caring for older people? As the government announces its social care plan, we'll ask why it's a compromise that pleases nobody. With a workfare, the Poundland ruling goes against the government, but the court does not rule that unpaid retail jobs count as slave labour. And we'll delve into the murkiest election of the year to find out who chooses the next pope. We ask how exactly you campaign for the top job at the Vatican. Joining me for all of this, we've got the Guardian reporter, Shiv Malik, and from Policy Exchange, the former number 10 advisor, Sean Worth, and our columnist and stalwart, Polly Toynbee. A warm welcome to you all. Now, despite our tasty menu of topics, we simply cannot begin without a quick canter around the horse meat course. When frozen supermarket beef burgers were found out to be mainly horse, there was hilarity all round. Jokes in Parliament, tabloid puns aplenty, and official advice that the meat was perfectly safe, even when labelled as something else. This week, though, as the full extent of the contamination and the mislabelling began to become apparent, there were long faces at the Department of the Environment. David Cameron has warned those responsible that there will be consequences.
I hope that... I hope people are genuinely worried about what they're buying at the supermarket, and I really think we've got to get a grip of this rather than make jokes about it. But I'll think of another one by the end of the session.
Shiv Malik, I'm vegetarian. I don't eat any of these animals. So, like many people, when this first broke, I thought, typical British sentimentality, feeling sorry for horses, but not other animals. But as the story rolls on, it looks like it is something else, a lack of control of the food chain, particularly maybe for people who are shopping on a tight budget.
Well, I should also declare that I was culturally Hindu, so we don't eat beef. We've been laughing since 1993, with the BSC crisis. But yes, I mean, it's been... the way in which it's unfolded has been remarkable, because it did start off as kind of this minor food scare, or perhaps not, in Ireland. And it's expanded across the entire EU, including sort of, you know, from everywhere from Romania to, and indeed, Ireland. And what seems to be most worrying is that we have no clue about where the sources of our food come from, and how varied those are. That, you know, you could have one product at the end of the day, you know, say a frozen lasagna, and that there's input from, you know, Romania and France and Ireland and, you know, a multitude of other countries is very worrying. And that, yes, we don't seem to be able to, you know, one person can sell horse meat and declare it as horse meat in one place, and then, but by the time it's minced up, it's suddenly now beef in France. I mean, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's come from, when we had the aspect of what was going on in Romania, i.e. they had to slaughter a lot of horses, and we all sort of tut-tutted and thought that's where the problem is. But actually, it could be now in Denmark or in France. We're not quite sure. We're still not sure.
And what does it make you think about, you know, nutritional information and all these other ingredients lists on food? Does it make you sort of wonder whether you can trust any of it?
Well, the governments, I think all governments have had a historic sort of problem with getting, you know, even basic things like, you know, the traffic light system on content in food, i.e., you know, whether this is good or bad for you. And it's incredibly incomprehensible to anyone who doesn't have basically a PhD in science to understand what these calories and salt content mean anyway. You know, most people just want to pick up their food and know that it basically says what it does on the tin. It's the Ronseal test for food. And then it's going to be either, you know, very fatty or not so fatty, that kind of thing. And we haven't even got to that stage. I mean, after years and years of legislation and all these worries.
Polly, you remember John Gummer feeding his daughter a burger. And I mean, there's a bit of a record of politicians struggle to get it right, don't they, when there's a problem with food?
It's very difficult because, you know, globalisation, a global food chain, it looks pretty disgusting when you see where it's travelled and through how many hands it's passed. And it does seem kind of crazy. But, you know, The Guardian has been really on this case. Felicity Lawrence, you Google back to her stuff over the years, has really been following this. And it comes down to the supermarkets determined to drive down prices so that you can get a value burger for 10p. Well, there is no way that a value burger for 10p is ever going to be full of anything but pretty disgusting stuff. It's going to be 30% fat. It's going to be extruded. It's going to be powdered cowhide. How about that? They're allowed to do that. And then it counts as added protein because it does add to the protein of the product. And on the back of the packet, it says seasoning. This is all Felicity's work. And it just shows how filthy the food is. But, of course, you know, desperately poor families in this country, you know, who shop with incredible care, people on benefits or people on in very low-paid jobs, going around looking at each thing to see what they can afford to put on their table for their children. It's part of the same old big story of extreme inequality means, you know, you and I might be able to afford to eat a hamburger that costs £1 and is made of real beef. If you eat one for 10p, it's going to be rubbish. And I think it's pretty horrible.
Do you think that's right, Sean?
I think this, like you, I unlike you, first of all, I like horse meat and I like eating meat. But like you, I did wonder whether the story would just sort of go away. I didn't really kind of see that it would roll on as far as it has. And it seems to me it's sort of going the way of arguments about sort of small shops and you know community pubs and stuff. It, you know, if people really want to have decent quality food, they've got to be prepared to pay for it, frankly. And Polly makes a point about poor people. This isn't a function of the recession. If you look at the amount of money we spend as a country on our food of our personal income, it's like half, and you know, comparable families, poor families, rich families, whatever, is half what they do on the continent, areas like France and Italy. They're just far less tolerant of, frankly, you know, pretty horrible looking and smelling and tasting food that is you know, the supply chain for which is halfway around the world. They're much more about local food and produce, and we're just not. So the government, you know, people are sort of looking at the government saying, oh, it's, you know, this is a recession, it's all terrible. But actually, I think it's more of a cultural thing about us and how we eat and what we spend our money on.
I looked at a product in the freezer in Morrison's when I was in there at the weekend, and I was just looking through with interest now. There is something called Turkey Jetters, presumably taking place from the disgraced Turkey Twizzlers, made by Bernard Matthews, and it's in the shape, they're little nuggety things in the shape of jet planes. Appeal to kids. Looked on the back, it's 28% turkey, and the rest of it is just filler. You know, and you could just, you know, you could feed your kids very cheaply on that, and you can see why people do, and the kids would probably eat it. But then people say, why are poor kids obese? Well, their parents may think they're feeding them turkey, but they're actually feeding them fat and batter and rubbish.
But what about this argument that, you know, the normal argument that you'd get on the liberal side on these things, liberal market side, would be consumers need to have informed choice. And then it comes down to how tightly you enforce the labelling. But in a single market, that has to be done Europe-wide, I imagine. It can't be, you know, we can't find out what's going on in slaughterhouse in Romania. And Brussels are now claiming that the reason that they aren't putting more strict rules about what needs to be written on the packets of food is because Britain's been so intransigent in resisting it. Do you think it could turn out to be an unexpected boon for the bureaucrat in Brussels, this scandal?
Well, there's definitely, you know, a role for ministers in this country to get on to ministers in other countries, and you know, I think they've already been talking about this rollout DNA testing and deal with labelling. But there are, you know, we do have leeway in this country to have specific labelling. I think the traffic light system that we were introducing, this showed that. You know, I think actually it's not a question of bureaucrats and regulations and all the rest of it. I think it will feed through, as I said earlier, to kind of cultural patterns and how we actually look at food. Actually, Polly made the point about poor people eating these turkey twizzlers and stuff. After this, I looked in the freezer. You know, we're not terribly poor, but we're not massively well off. But I looked at, you know, and the stuff we're giving our kids is actually pretty awful as well. We eat chicken nuggets and all sorts of things. So, you know, everyone has to have a rethink, I think, about what they're eating at home.
People who require expensive social care in old age are to have the cost capped at £75,000. The move announced this week is the government's solution to the so-called scandal in which people are forced to sell their homes to fund their long-term care. Sean, the government commissioned Andrew Dilnot, the economist, to conduct an inquiry into what was the right way forward here, and he recommended this business of a cap, but they've gone for the Dilnot principle, but it's a kind of cut price Dilnot, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my view on this, I've actually worked on this sort of policy area for years and years, going back to when I was an academic, very many years ago. I think this is certainly not the answer to the social care problem, and I'd call it a crisis. I think it really is a real problem in this country. A cap on the liabilities that you will face as an individual over your lifetime, I think is the right thing to do, because it has been preventing, you know, insurance markets emerging, for example, that would allow people to prepare for their old age. But what it needs to be is part of a package, and this is why I don't get hung up on where the cap is. I mean, the cap is a function of how much public money we've got to spend on it. And frankly, if we have got public money left, I think it should actually go into the council system, which is really in difficulty. I think what it really needs to be...
But would you do that rather than the cap?
No, I'd do a cap. Look, I think we need a cap. People need to pay in their own money. It's as simple as that. We don't have enough money to pump loads of cash into the system in an ageing population, in an unreformed social care market. We need a really, really big set of reforms. I hope that the cap is one part of it. I hope that we look at the funding, which I think is a complete mess. It comes from partly from the councils, partly from us, partly from the NHS, partly from the state. I hope that we'll get some real political capital behind a whole raft of reforms to make that first the market much more innovative, and the cap will help because it will bring insurers and people in, but also to sort out basic stuff like eligibility and standards of quality of care. It's not just a question of cash, it's about reform.
Polly, you certainly agree from what you wrote this week that this can't be the whole solution, but you seem to be even harsher in your judgment than that.
Well, I think they're asking the wrong question. What is the crisis in care? You're quite right, Sean, there's a crisis in care. It's that there is very little of it. It's shrinking fast. It's pretty dreadful. You're getting carers who have 15-minute appointments to see people very, very severely handicapped in their own home. There just isn't enough good care out there. Carers aren't even paid for the travel time from one home to another. It's a shocker of a system. So the first thing you say is, how do we protect people with some property for keeping their property after they die to hand on to their middle-aged children who by then have already got their own homes? That is an interesting question, but it's not the crisis. And so it seems to me the government's putting quite a lot of money into the wrong issue. If you're going to do that, having a cap is quite sensible. You might as well set the cap high so that you don't waste too much government money on it. But it isn't going to get a new insurance system going. All of the insurance companies are saying so, partly because people aren't interested in insuring for care. They'd sort of probably wisely take a view, this is the lottery of life. I might be lucky, I might be unlucky in terms of how much I have to spend on my care. I'd rather not insure. But if people did want to, a much better system would be, which Labour had been moving towards rather nervously at the end of their time in office, if everybody had to pay, say, £10,000 or £20,000 on retirement automatically, compulsorily, into a care pool, it would be enough to hugely increase the amount of care available and guarantee they'd never have to pay any more. So, anybody who's got a property, they wouldn't have to sell their house. It could simply be a lien on their house for after they die. Say you £20,000 worth of your house went into it. That would solve the problem. But then, you know, the Tories ran big posters saying this is a death tax, and I think that would be the right way around.
What do you think, Shiv? I mean, it's going to be a hard sell, isn't it? Like, £20,000, there goes your lump sum would be the poster.
I think that would be really difficult. The people do have serious problems with lump sum. But the whole sort of payments upon, especially as they're just about to retire, but the whole problem with Britain, I think, has been that we're terrible at long-term planning. Certainly one group of people who haven't, and I'm taking the intergenerational angle here, who haven't been involved in this debate are the people actually who'd be doing the bulk of the payment in the sort of, you know, if they're not actually benefiting for themselves, which is younger taxpayers. You know, we've known for 30 years, a good 30 years, that people are living longer, and we've sat on our hands as a country and thought, well, we won't do anything until we're in a crisis situation, which now everyone agrees that that's the case. And then, of course, it's always then the people who are the youngest in these situations who've already had to suffer in many different ways from, how, you know, either whether it's university fees or the massive whopping rises in rents or house prices, all these other things that they've had to, that they're still paying out for and will be paying out for. And now they'll have to pay out for the older section of the population again. And of course, pensioners generally haven't been facing, and that's a deliberate political strategy, not facing any cuts deliberately targeted at them. They may face them in other ways. So it's intergenerationally unfair, and it comes about because no one wanted to plan for any of this, because no one actually wanted to think about it sensibly and have a grown-up political debate about what pain might be faced, i.e. what costs might we have to accrue to do this properly in the future. Now, the future, the thing about the future is it always arrives.
Let's just zoom there into the other end of the spectrum in what you're calling the age wars, because this week you've been reporting on the case of Kate Riley, a young woman who was doing volunteering that she wanted to do, and got told by the job centre that she had to go and work in Poundland for free instead. Shiv, fill us in on that.
Well, it's sort of complicated judgment, I think. And the judges didn't really help themselves. There were three of them. And they, by creating this very inarticulate judgment, it was really difficult to wade through. It was very difficult to also pull out a sentence that was kind of quotable as well. So the case started off, it's been running for about a year. And it started off with the lawyer saying, right, we're going to take the government to court, saying to have a judicial review, because we don't feel that under the Human Rights Act, we think that working for your benefits is a form of forced or slave labour. And that's what's dominated the headlines. Actually, when you got to court and you got to listen to their arguments, you realised that by the time they got there, they'd actually relegated that to a sort of a second division in their argument. And their main argument was this, was that actually it's unfair for the government not to, in fact, it's ultra vires, it goes against their own rules, not to write down what these schemes were, which is what got struck down in the courts. Now, that sounds like a technicality, and actually both, you know, people on left or right, supporters of this kind of thing or not, have said that this is a technicality. But it's, I don't think it is. I think it harkens back to something actually much more vital, a principle than any other thing that's been discussed so far, which is that it's one way of controlling the lives of others is to devise systems around which that they don't know the rules. If you don't tell them what the rules are, then they're already at a disadvantage. And that's basically what the Secretary of State has done for a very long time, since, you know, May 2010, when these systems were rolled out. And that's left unemployed people at a real disadvantage. They don't know why they're being sanctioned effectively. I mean, they're told why, but they don't know if that's lawful. And now it's all been struck down and called unlawful.
Sean, we always get this line, don't we, about unemployed people who won't play by the rules. But doesn't Shiv make a good point there, which is that, you know, you couldn't tell, for example, pensioners or any other section of the population that they've got to play by the rules without telling them what the rules were?
Yeah, well, I think the baby boomer generation, the pensioners, is actually the most selfish in this country. And all the questions we were talking about earlier about social care planning, you know, they're blocking whole rafts of progressive policy.
Much encouraged by your government.
No, it's been successive governments over time. They've voted in basically socialist governments that have doled out benefits for them, and now they're at this position where they've got £1 trillion of housing assets. They've got this lovely, you know, rural idyllic views out of their kitchen windows. They refuse to change any of this stuff. They refuse to change the planning system. They're getting welfare payouts to pension millionaires who don't need them, but nobody dares say any. I haven't heard Labour say anything about this. It's an absolute outrage. And yeah, you're right that all the pain is sort of focused on working age people. But I mean, on the question of workfare, you know, there is nothing compassionate about leaving people parked on benefits for years and years. And you're right, it does the behavioural, you know, I don't believe that this is uniform across the unemployed people. I've been unemployed myself, you know, and been on benefits. You know, you do not get people refusing to work in large swathes, but there are some, and workfare does deal with that, and it's been shown internationally to work. It discourages what some people call dependency. But I think, you know, it needs some more progressive reform around it, and I think Policy Exchange have been calling for an end to the trade union system of national pay bargaining in the public sector, which would actually free up some money for some schemes in the worst areas of unemployment, so you can actually attach subsidised jobs to workfare, and that would really, really help people in those poorest positions.
But I mean, what about this particular scheme? Because we've got this young woman, Kate Riley, you know, she'd come through, done a degree, and then actually taken some initiative, set herself up with a placement in the museum where she was minimum wage at first and then unpaid. I mean, it seems pretty crude to say, well, she was doing all of that and not laying about, but working very hard, trying to get her foot on the ladder, then being told to go and do something which looks to most people just like unpaid labour that doesn't take you anywhere.
Again, the left sort of see this as a sort of horrible thing that the government wants to do to the unemployed. If you look at the evidence, one of the biggest negative effects of unemployment is called what labour market people call scarring, where the longer you're out of work, the worse you look to an employer because you basically haven't got a recent record of doing anything.
Look, everyone agrees with that. We all agree that unemployment is really bad for people.
And there'll
That's
be these
true.
Cases where, yeah, I'm a graduate in museum studies or whatever and they're making me work in Poundland. Isn't that awful?
An internship. So why do you take her out of an internship for something that might lead to a job and make her sweep the floors for free for Poundland, whom I don't know if they're donors to the Tory party or whatever, but why? When she's doing voluntary work in the public sector, isn't that a better thing for her to do?
Well, it depends on the skills you're getting. You know, Poundland is actually a really good employer, but a lot of people on the left have been very sniffy about Poundland. They're actually a very, very good employer. They provide tons of jobs and they provide really good skills.
To the Tory party.
They do. No, I have no idea.
Well, the evidence seems to show actually that the schemes that are voluntary, i.e., where people have some choice about the kinds of things that they do, so not whether they do work experience or not, and everyone can probably agree that actually, you know, doing some routines of work, they are good things, and they do have evidential basis for saying yes, they improve confidence and all those soft skills. They don't incidentally help people get a job compared to other people who don't do these schemes, you know, the government's done extensive research on it because they're desperate to find it that it does, haven't found it. But if when you do give people a little modicum of choice, it does actually improve that basis, just a little bit. Mm. And this is actually, I mean, this is a classic right-wing point. Why is a cold bureaucracy instructing people and not being flexible with individual choices? So when Kate Riley says, look, I'm doing exactly the same thing, but in a museum where I have a geology degree, why do I have to then go and work in Poundland where I've already got retail experience? And the answer is, it's mandatory. Turns out that it wasn't, by the way, because there were no rules, so no one knew what the rules were. And if you don't do it, we'll sanction you. We'll make you destitute. That just seems to be, from a classic right-wing point of view, the wrong thing to be doing.
The other ingredient is that when Michael Heseltine brought in a workfare scheme at the end of the John Major government, it really worked rather well. People were paid a bit extra on top of their benefit. You worked for something. There was recognition that you weren't just getting the bare amount you'd need to survive, which if you're a kid this girl's age is sort of 50 quid a week, which is desperate, you get extra. The Labour's Future Jobs Fund worked really well, and all the research from the National Institute has produced saying it was the most effective scheme there's been. People were paid the minimum wage, and they worked for charities, for local authorities. They weren't working for commercial companies stacking shelves in Tesco, where companies then make a lot of money out of it and also deprive other people, because their shelves can only be stacked a certain amount. Other people who would have been employed sweeping floors in Poundland are deprived a job. It just isn't the right thing to do to put them into commercial situations where there's going to be job displacement if you do it on any sort of scale.
That since then, by the way, has been made voluntary. So before, where it used to be basically mandatory to work in private enterprises, that this time last year, there was another battle over all of this where Tesco's themselves sort of basically threatened the government that we'd pull out unless you made it all voluntary and people wouldn't be sanctioned for leaving.
Don't you think there's just a difference with public opinion here? Public opinion certainly quite strongly thinks people shouldn't get benefits for nothing. They should be required to do something. But unlike, I think, a lot of civil servants and people in government, I think the public are very, very suspicious as well about Tesco or Poundland or whoever getting help for free. They see that what they're getting out of this is a free lunch. And when the voters are so cross, they don't like to see anyone getting a free lunch.
Well, Policy Exchange actually did some polling on this very recently and I think asked the question, I don't remember what it was exactly, it was something like, you know, after a year of unemployment, is it right that people should have to go and do a bit of work in return for their benefits? And 80% of people said yes, and the question was actually much less leading than I've just described. So, you know, and the left has been completely on the wrong side of the argument on welfare, and it's a real problem for Labour, and you know, I think for the benefit of debate, they really need to come out with some new ideas rather than just opposing everything, because they're completely on the wrong side of the public on this. But Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, the public supporter, but that's actually not the most important thing. The most important thing is to deal with this scarring effect of unemployment, and I think it's actually a compassionate move to help give help and labour market attachment to people that have been unemployed for a long time. But if you get a situation where, yeah, Tesco and some brands are exploiting them, I don't know if they are, I've seen reports of it, that is something you need to crack down on. But don't let that detract from the principle of workfare, which is, in some cases, very, very useful to give people experience and attachment to the labour market, which is one of the main reasons employers
don't be complacent
them.
About thinking that Labour's on the wrong side of this argument. Opinion polls are beginning to show there's quite a shift, because people are suddenly, when they hear stories, I mean, Ed Miliband produced one in PMQs at Cameron last week, saying, what about the woman who's got two twin sons in Afghanistan fighting, aged 18, and she's told she's got to move because she's got spare bedrooms, so they've got nowhere to come home to. All of a sudden, the sheer savagery of what's happening to the entire benefit system, particularly the housing benefit, particularly the disability benefit still to come, cuts still to come in. People are saying, oh, but I didn't mean people like them. Of course, I don't want skivers. I don't want people, you know, I'm working hard and I don't want people sitting back while I'm working hard. But on the other hand, the, oh, I didn't mean them, is going to get stronger and stronger throughout. By the end of this year, I think Labour's going to be ahead on the benefits, because the government has made such a hash of it. I mean, in the case of this girl, it's quite a good one, because, you know, it was plainly the wrong thing to do for this person at that time, who was already working.
Well, let's leave that there for now and move on to another murky story of secretive horse trading. The announcement of the retirement of Benedict XVI means that the Vatican needs to elect a new pope. As ever on this podcast, we are fascinated not only in the who, what and when of elections, but also in the how. We asked The Guardian's resident religious affairs expert, our columnist Andrew Brown, to explain how the election campaign is shaking up. Is it votes or simply a smoke signal that decides it?
It is votes. The smoke signals merely announce the result of the votes. And curiously, for such a very autocratic position, it's an almost entirely democratic procedure. It's got a very small, very select electorate who are almost all chosen by the man whose replacement they are about to choose. But when the cardinals go into the Sistine Chapel, they are completely cut off from the outside world. There's all sorts of electronic screening to stop their conversations being bugged. They have no mobile phones, no iPads, no means of communication with the outside world at all, except this fireplace in which they can burn the ballots to produce either white or black smoke to show they've got a result.
So secret ballots, is it? Reassuring that in the end it comes down to a vote. Like everything else in high politics, Andrew. But is it one vote or is it going to be many votes? What are we expecting?
No, it's many votes, because the successful candidate has to get a two-thirds majority of the voting cardinals. And this means that there has to be a very great deal of discussion and horse trading before any candidate can emerge, usually, because the cardinals align in different blocks, partly according to their geography, partly according to their party allegiance, so to say, and also according to what they think the most urgent job facing the next pope is. And what is extraordinary is that though it's a very small electorate, it's a very direct democracy. I mean, any member of it could, in theory, become Pope themselves.
How political is that job once you've got it? There's clearly then a lot of political machinations in becoming the Pope.
It's quite extraordinarily political at the moment in the internal churchy sense, and this is one of the ways in which Benedict XVI fell down, because by all accounts, he's a sort of gentle scholar who's really no good with the bother boots and the razor blades. And that is really the equipment you need to deal with the Vatican bureaucracy, though some people feel a flamethrower would also be helpful.
In this extraordinary hidden world, Andrew, you've got a hundred and however many people who are voting and who are potential popes themselves. Is it one of those things like Speaker of the House of Commons where it's not the done thing to let it be known that you're in the running and you need to be dragged kicking and screaming to the chair or the altar or whatever it is?
Well, again, like being Speaker of the House of Commons, you have to make sure that enough people know that you need to be dragged kicking and screaming, or else it will never happen. But there is the fine old saying that whoever enters the conclave as a pope will leave it as a cardinal. You have to be quite discreet in your politicking. You have to look surprised when you get the thing, and quite often you are surprised. I mean, some candidates come as a shock to the electorate as well. I think the election of John Paul II was an example, the Polish Pope in 1979, and possibly the election of Pope John XXIII in 1958 was another example. And again, once you've got the job, you are an autocrat. You can do pretty much what you like. So you can imagine, and this has sometimes happened, a sort of stealth candidate who appears to be one thing and then turns out to stand for a quite different programme. And the other point, of course, is it's a real job. It's not a ceremonial job like being the Queen. This is why the present Pope has resigned, because you actually have to take a lot of decisions, chiefly personnel decisions. And in that way, you shape the Church and the College of Cardinals that will choose your successor. But you also have to have not just the political skills to become a cardinal and then a pope, but considerable political and diplomatic skills in dealing with the outside world after that. You know, one casual wrong phrase in a speech and you can set off riots.
And if we think of this electorate chosen, I think, exclusively by Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II, because between the two of them, they've gone right the way back to the 70s, if you've said. And so they've both been appointed by, as I understand it, relatively conservative popes. Does that mean all these electors are conservatives and the liberal candidates can't get a look in?
Pretty much, with the reservation that I just made, that when somebody becomes the pope, you never know what they're going to do. It's possible that someone feels, you can imagine a candidate who feels very strongly that it's his duty to obey the Pope and to suppress such doubts as he may have until he becomes the Pope. And I think there has been one area in which orthodoxy has been very firmly exercised in the last 20 or 30 years, and this is any kind of public doubt or dissent about the doctrines on birth control has been an absolute bar to promotion. On the other hand, I find it very, very hard to believe that among 117 highly intelligent men, and whatever else you may think of them, there are no real fools in the College of Cardinals. None of them has noticed that this isn't working, so to say.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Shiv Malik and to Sean Worth. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.